Hello, everybody. It's Sam from Financial Samurai. And in this podcast, we're going to talk about how to purchase property below fair market value with just a few words. Now, the property market is really hot in many parts of the country. Although, you know, it is slowing in places like New York, Vancouver, Toronto, even Seattle is seeing a slowdown because of a massive amount of supply. That said, prices are higher than they were a year ago, and they are much higher than they were several years ago. And as a result, you need to be very, very diligent, very prudent in your negotiation process, because you don't want to be the buyer at the top of the market just in case the market turns. Nobody knows when the market will turn, but we do know that the property market has done really well since 2010, since 2012, and in some places, you know, the markets are up 100%. So it goes to show you that the higher prices go without the commensurate increase in wage inflation, the higher valuations are going, especially since rents haven't been keeping up in some places. So you want to be really careful, because if you buy property with leverage, you're going to get crushed in a downturn if you have to sell. So I believe everyone is a master negotiator inside. And this is where the skill of written communication, copywriting, is very, very important when it comes to try to buy a property below fair market value. There are three things everyone must do when it comes to negotiating a property purchase. The first thing you have to do is focus on making a connection. It's important to find some common interest between you and the seller. You can always find out something about the seller's background via an online search, or you can ask your real estate agent to ask their real estate agent about the seller and what their motives are. Perhaps they're selling because of a divorce, or perhaps they're selling because they want to relocate to a school district that's better for them, or maybe it's a job relocation. Whatever the case may be, find out what that common thread between you two is and highlight that in your email or in your formal letter to them. Just look at top management of companies. They all look alike. If it's a white CEO, all the other C-level people will be white and male if it's a white male CEO. And the same goes for if it's an Asian person or a Latina person or a black person. Everybody tends to favor and be more comfortable with people who have similar interests to them or who look like them. So you've got to tell the seller how much their home would mean to you. Talk about the children you plan to play with in the backyard. Talk about your shared love of the Golden State Warriors. Salute their charitable efforts. That's actually a big one. People really like to be recognized for their charitable efforts. So if you can talk about something like that in your letter, I think the seller will really, really, really like that. Also, in your letter, it's very important to share with them who you are and why you are a good person and a good buyer. Selling a home is extremely emotional, especially if you've lived in it for many, many years. A seller would much rather sell to a family who works, for example, at a nonprofit looking to eradicate poverty than to a 25-year-old trust fund kid who just graduated from college and doesn't know what to do with his life, right? These things matter. Showing who you are as a buyer matters. The purchaser of my home last year wrote a nice letter that told me how much he loved my house's brick facade. That's interesting because I loved my house's brick facade because it reminded him and me of the colonial homes in Virginia where we both grew up and went to college. So he was very smart in that way. Also, he had a girlfriend and a 2-year-old son, and my wife was pregnant with a son. So all these things kind of clicked where I said, you know what? I'm willing to hear you out and entertain your offer, even though I wasn't that motivated to sell. So the second strategy in your letter or in your email communication is to allude to end of world scenarios. So what does this mean? It's very stressful. It's very stressful to be a seller than a buyer. Much more stressful being a seller than a buyer. Buyers can simply shop around with no commitments. They can walk away anytime they want. But if you're a seller, you're putting yourself out there. Right? You're putting your property online for the world to see and to analyze and to criticize. It's kind of like blogging or podcasting. You put yourself out there at the mercy of very critical people who don't bother to put themselves out there themselves. As a seller, you're signing a contract with a real estate agent for 3 to 5 to 6%, and you're allowing strangers to walk into your house, rummage through your stuff, you know, scuff up your floors. And the seller also knows that if they don't sell within a certain period of time, the property goes stale fish. which means people start wondering after, let's say, 30 days, what's wrong with the property? Usually it's just the price, but, you know, what else could be wrong? Is, the neighbor kind of shady, or what's going on? So it's really embarrassing to put yourself out there and get rejected. And so that's why, as a seller, it's much more stressful. As a buyer, you need to recognize this. Stress is a killer in terms of negotiations. So using the end of the world strategy can really motivate your seller to offload the property at a discount. You can start with big picture scenarios by discussing, let's say, what would happen to the property market if the stock market took a 50% correction like it did in 2008 and 2009. Then you can move on to discuss what would happen if there was a terrorist attack. Finally, you can talk about all the natural disasters that have been occurring all around the country every single year. Earthquakes, flooding, fires, tornadoes. It just seems to go on and on and on. And I don't know if it's because social media has connected us so closely, but it seems like every year there's some big, big disaster that affects all of us in some way, or almost affects us. Your goal as the buyer is to make the seller believe their house is a riskier asset than it really is. I remember when I was in the process of selling my property, I kept thinking how lucky I was to have escaped a big earthquake during my 13 years of ownership in San Francisco. The house was in the Marina District. It's a really nice district, but the Marina District has really loose soil because it's reclaimed land from the ocean. And this soil is susceptible to liquefaction, which causes houses to fall and crumble in case of an earthquake. So every San Franciscan and Bay Area resident probably is waiting for the big one to hit in the back of their minds. And it's been decades. I think it's been over 30 years. And they say a big one always hits every 30 to 50 years. So it's just a matter of time. So if the buyer of my property smartly pressed on the risk of damage in an earthquake by asking me about the soil underneath the house, a topography map, and whether I had experienced any earthquake damage during my time of ownership, I probably would not have negotiated as hard. I would have sensed his fear of risk, which would in turn made me more fearful of losing him as a buyer because it would conjure up all these worries all over again. So look, using this end of the world scenario is not a really nice move, but you're negotiating to save money for you and your family. The key is to ask about the potential risk of each scenario, not tell. Because if you're telling, then you're going to be arrogant and you might piss off the seller. But by asking, you get the seller thinking about worst case scenarios. And that's all that matters, to get them thinking in order to come down in price. And a final strategy I recommend everybody to deploy is to focus on the benefits of a simple life. Life is much simpler renting and owning fewer things. We all know this. The minimalists have all found out this long ago. A simple life is the reason why I'm not in a rush to buy another physical property. If I'm going to buy another physical property, I'm actually going to be a landlord because I already like my house. I enjoy everything. Bad tenants, leaky roofs, endless maintenance, and ever-increasing property tax are generally terrible things that can be controlled if you don't buy property. A simpler life is why I'm focused on real estate crowdfunding because, hey, I can buy a whole bunch of properties across the country, not have to deal with anything, and if I can earn a 10 to 15% annual return, sign me up, really sign me up. So the older the property seller, the more appealing a simple life free from property maintenance will be. Any property owner after a decade of ownership will have experienced a lot of stress due to maintenance or tenant issues if they're a landlord. But you can still argue about the joys of a simpler life to younger property sellers too, because they can definitely remember what it was like as a renter since they were a renter not so long ago. So the way to convince the seller about the benefits of a simple life is to highlight all the remodeling and upgrades you plan to do to the property. Now, you don't want to do it in a way that offends the seller because they'll be like, wait, what's wrong with my property? You're going to do all this? It's not good enough for you? You've got to do it in a relatively subtle way. But if you do it right, not only do you make the seller feel good knowing you plan to take care of the house after purchase, by discussing all the work you plan to do, you also remind the seller of how much work she has to do if she were to keep the property. So for my house, My old house's kitchen and two bathrooms were last remodeled in 1995. So that's well over 25 years ago, and they're due. They're due for some refreshing here. I had a 20 plus year old HVAC unit that needed replacing. My back windows in the property, no matter how much I caulked around them or inspected them, always leaked during the winter because you could see the dry rot and the wet sheetrock on the bottom of the windows. And also, I had an intermittent leaky light well that dripped through my dining room ceiling. It's done that a couple times, so I went up there and I sprayed the heck out of it with Flexol, this product, and I don't know how long that's going to last, hopefully at least another year, but it's just a matter of time before I have to change the roof as well. So if I had kept the house, I would have had to have spent $100,000 to maybe $300,000 on remodeling the house, maybe even more actually, because it's a nice house. The whole process would have been a huge pain, which gives me kind of like PTSD, because just dealing with the, you know, the planning committee, with contractors who are always late and they never stick with budget, and they're never, you know, they just don't do what they say they're going to do, and the need for permits, and also the inspectors who come and inspect the plumbing, the electrical, and the building. All that stuff is really, really stressful. And if you're going to remodel, you might as well remodel everything and get it over with. Not so much, here's the bathroom and go through the permit process, and then here's the kitchen, let's go through the permit process. You want to get everything together. So I wasn't going to spend that much time and money for a rental, which I wasn't even going to live in. So I decided to let the property go. So in conclusion, I want to urge everyone to work on your negotiation skills and your written communication skills. It's the same concept with negotiating a severance. The people who don't believe they can negotiate a severance have no negotiating skills. They don't understand human psychology. They're not aware of the needs of the manager and the corporations. They're unable to create a positive win-win scenario. So you need to work on these skills. Part of the reason why I'm doing these podcasts is so that I can work on my verbal communication skills. Everybody has their preferences. If you can figure out what they are and make a connection, you can probably get between 1% to 5% off fair market value. And 1% to 5% doesn't seem like a lot, but it really is, because prices are at all-time highs. I mean, think about it. $1 million house, $1.5 million, $2 million, $5 million. You know, these things matter. And I would argue that the higher the price point, the more this connection you make and you create matters. Because wealthier people, they want their homes, their properties to go to people who they think are good people, right? I mean, if it's like, you know, you own 30 crappy rentals and, you know, it doesn't really matter. Just give me the most amount of money. But if there's something that's really sentimental, that really means a lot to this seller and is at a high price point, I mean, they have more wiggle room, right? Look at the margins of high-end cars. Their margins are huge, BMWs, Mercedes. That's why they're so much more profitable than companies like Toyota, where their margins, their profit margins are very small. So if you think about that analogy, there is a lot more wiggle room to discount. If my San Francisco rental house buyer could have made a connection with me over tennis and got me paranoid about an 8+ Richter scale earthquake hitting in the next 5 years, I don't know how he would do that in a nice way, but I probably would have sold the house for $140,000 less, which is 5% less than I did. So I sold it for $2.74 million. I would have sold it for $2.6 million because even at 5% less, $2.6 million, it was still $100,000 higher than my aspirational price of $2.5 million. Now, he doesn't know that, but I'm telling you this, and that's just the way negotiations are. But don't feel bad for my buyer. My house will do very well for him given how strong the San Francisco Bay Area economy is. I'm the one who occasionally feels bad about selling until I remind myself how difficult it was to deal with tenants and maintain a 1926 built house as a landlord. It also feels nice to no longer owe a mortgage and write $24,000 a year property tax checks every year, right? Even though my kid has no guarantee of getting to the public school of choice. For those of you who choose to continue to rent, look, that's your prerogative. That's fine too. Just make sure you follow my Burl strategy, which is buy utility, rent luxury, and continuously invest your extra cash flow to beat inflation and to just stay ahead of the game with regards to all this asset price appreciation. If you remain disciplined by consistently investing the difference, you'll probably do fine. But if you don't, I promise you, you'll wish 20 years from now that you held onto your property or that you bought a property today, even at record highs. Thanks, everybody, and I'd love to know some of your strategies you've deployed to try and get a discount from a property seller, or frankly, anything you wanted to buy.